We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is our morning talk program. We're here this morning in this part of the show to talk a little bit about audio documentary. And our guest for the show is Matt Ehrlich. He's a professor of journalism here at the University of Illinois. And we'll talk about a book that he has authored. It's just come out recently. The title of his book is Radio Utopia, Post-War Audio Documentary in the Public Interest. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. Probably some of the most moving reporting to come out of World War II arrived in America's homes through the radio. And when the war came to an end, one of the most famous voices of that time, Ed Murrow, said, or at least it's said that he said, "We've seen what radio can do for the nation in war. Let's go back and show what we can do in peace." And that is what Matt is trying to do with this book, is to look at a fairly narrow window in which big commercial radio broadcasters in this country were creating some pretty significant work in terms of audio documentary, dealing with some big issues. And the people who were making these programs were really interested in trying to use the medium of sound to make the world a better place. So we'll talk a little bit about this. In fact, we even have a couple of examples that we can play as we talk. And questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send us an email, you can do that as well. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. I could not resist using that quote from Murrow, but I guess
it's
we should say
it's
so good. I couldn't.
It's
couldn't
almost too good.
Not use it, and maybe that's the thing. But I guess there are some people who question whether, in fact, he did say that.
Well, it came out of one of Murrow's biographies by A.M. Sperber, and it was based on what someone had told her. Actually, an interview that she had done with Robert Louis Cheyenne, who's another subject of the book, another documentarian of that era. But if you look back at the, that quote was supposedly from about 1945 in Europe. And if you look at the diaries of that period, there's no such notation of anything like that ever having taken place. But the spirit behind the quote, I think, was true. Radio, as you were mentioning, was a very powerful medium, arguably the most powerful news medium during World War II, because due to the rationing of newsprint and so forth, the print media were somewhat hampered in what they could do. And so it was carrying over that power that radio had demonstrated during the war, and also that idealism, the war, the good war, as Studs Terkel referred to it, and taking it home and showing, as you said, what radio could do for the nation in a time of peace.
So whether or not he said that or anybody said that, there were people who had that in mind.
Yeah, it was this sense of idealism and optimism that was fueled by the war, fueled by the victory over fascism, fueled by the fact that America was obviously the predominant world power at the end of the war due to the destruction in Europe and much of Asia, and just kind of feeling its oats and exerting that power. Also, it was kind of imposed upon the radio industry due to regulatory pressures. The Federal Communications Commission, right at the end of World War II, had issued something called the Blue Book Report, which essentially said to broadcasters, you are too commercial, you are not taking your public service responsibilities seriously enough, and if you do not demonstrate enhanced public service or enhanced commitment to public service, then your licenses may be at stake. So there was some external pressure as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the period that you particularly concentrate on the book is actually a fairly small one, fairly mm-hmm. short, and it goes from the period right after World War II, where starting out there, where radio was the dominant medium to the point where very quickly radio becomes eclipsed by television. And in fact, I think some of the people who are doing this kind of thing in radio then simply moved over and did it in television.
Well, Edward R. Murrow certainly did.
He did. Yeah.
And the demonstration of that is they did he and Fred Friendly produced a radio series for CBS called Hear It Now that was only on the air for about 6 months between the end of 1950 and the summer of 1951. And that moved to television, and that, of course, was See It Now, which most people have heard of, that did the very famous programs on McCarthyism in 1953 and 1954. So they made the transition to television, but a lot of the other people that I write about in the book did not, and that wasn't necessarily their choice, and it wasn't necessarily the fact that they could not adapt or could not have adapted had they been given the opportunity. It's that some of them ended up being blacklisted. So 1945 to 1951, we see a lot of extraordinary transformations from radio to television, from post-war idealism to Cold War fear, and also technological change in radio. A lot of things that we take for granted now, that you can go out outside with a recorder of some sort and actually capture audio and then produce news stories like the ones you hear every day on AM 580. You couldn't do that in 1945 and 1946, at least not very easily. And that technology was developed in that same time frame. So there are also technological changes within radio that people had to adapt to.
Well, I want to come. I want to come back to that, but before doing that, go to the. Have you talk about what sort of stories these people wanted to tell, then and then given their political tenor, maybe that became an issue later. But when you first start into this period, what you know, maybe he didn't say that, but there was this idea that there were important issues that needed to be dealt with, important stories that needed to be told, and darn it, we were going to go do that. What was it that they wanted to do?
They wanted to focus on pressing issues of domestic concern and also international concern. But immediately after World War II, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, and we can go back and we know that that was a time of growing prosperity and the baby boom started right after World War II. Nobody obviously knew as of 1945 that was going to happen. There were concerns that the birth rate might actually go down. There were concerns that depression might return in America. There were concerns about delinquency, about the nation's youth. And, of course, there were concerns about atomic science, because even though the United States was the only country for at least a few years after the war to have the atomic bomb, that really unsettled a lot of people, what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So they did documentary programs on everything from the topics we just mentioned, juvenile delinquency, to the nation's healthcare system. There were concerns that America's healthcare system might not be quite up to par. You can see how much has changed since 1946. There were concerns about atomic energy, or I should say there were concerns about atomic weapons, but there were also thoughts about what can we do with the atom that might actually help the world. So there were programs done on actually one called The Sunny Side of the Atom. And the title really tells you the tenor of that particular program. So a wide range of stuff. Venereal disease, which was extremely taboo in American broadcasting and elsewhere as of 1947 when this program was produced on ABC. Eric Barno, who some people may know as a broadcast professor at Columbia University and a documentary historian, actually produced a program on venereal disease, and he pitched the idea to Dwight Eisenhower, who was president of Columbia. There was a little time between him being the general during World War II and moving into politics, and Dwight Eisenhower was supposed to have said, "I'm just delighted we're actually going to do something that isn't way up in the academic clouds." And so they did a whole range of stuff, and because of the technological limitations that we just talked about in radio technology, they did them in docudrama format. So if we have some examples that we can listen to, that will demonstrate that. But what we think of as a documentary today, nobody knew, just as they didn't know what was going to happen in America or the world, nobody knew what a documentary would evolve into on radio and television. So they were kind of flying by the seat of their pants and making it up as they went along.
Yeah, I want to play something in just a second, but to again take that point a little bit further, I think that it's pretty striking that the big commercial networks, CBS, ABC, NBC, were actually willing to broadcast things that dealt with very controversial subjects like juvenile delinquency or venereal disease, the kind of thing that this was not openly discussed. And for them to put something like that on the air, it seems surprising that they would do it.
Well, they did it for a number of reasons. One was for prestige. One was for in response to the regulatory pressures that we mentioned in terms of the Blue Book report saying you have to demonstrate increased commitment to public service. And then, frankly, even though they did air these reports, they didn't always air them at a time when vast audiences would be listening to them. They did air them in prime time. So you would hear these on a week night, 7 p.m., 8 p.m. or whatever. But for example, CBS did their juvenile delinquency documentary called The Eagles Brood. They aired that program against Bing Crosby's program. Other programs that CBS aired would be aired against Bob Hope, who was the number one rated program on radio right after World War II. So it was kind of like they were saying, well, we're going to lose this time period anyway, so we'll just slip this in here. And so the audiences were not nearly what they might have been had they aired them at some other time. But still, this is network radio, the number one broadcast medium right after World War II. And so we're still talking millions of people actually were exposed to these programs. And the networks put quite a bit of promotion behind them, especially CBS, which was known for promoting their material.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Matt Ehrlich. He's professor of journalism at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. We are talking about some of what you'll find in a book that he's authored. It's titled Radio Utopia, Postwar Audio Documentary in the Public Interest. The subtitle published by the University of Illinois Press. And it takes a look at a six-year period where there was a real boom in audio documentary work dealing with important political, social issues. These programs were produced for and aired on the big networks on radio, ABC, CBS, NBC. And then fairly quickly, what work there was of that moved over to television, and it was a brief time. And if you're certainly interested, you can take a look at the book. And there is a website for the book where there are a number of audio clips that people can listen to. That's where we've pulled a couple of things from. And you just mentioned Eagles Brood. And we have an excerpt from that I'd like to play. You want to talk a little bit more about The Eagles Brood?
The Eagles Brood was written and produced by Robert Louis Cheyenne. He was the person who was handpicked by Edward R. Murrow to be part of the CBS radio documentary unit right after World War II. He was not trained as a journalist, not like Murrow and the so-called Murrow boys, Howard K. Smith, Eric Severide, William Shirer, all those folks. He was actually a radio dramatist. He wrote radio dramas promoting the war effort. So he was dispatched by CBS to go on a nationwide tour to investigate the conditions contributing to juvenile delinquency. And he literally went all over the country, saw really horrible things. This was about a month-long tour late in 1946. And he ended up in Chicago and talked to Saul Alinsky, the neighborhood organizer, and decided that was the solution to juvenile delinquency, not top-down government solutions, but neighborhood activism, grassroots activism in communities all across the country. And so he wrote a hour-long program that aired in March of 1947 on CBS, and again, CBS promoted it very aggressively. Again, no recordings used at all. This was done all live in the studio with a live orchestra and Hollywood actors playing the parts of the real-life characters that Cheyenne was writing about. So taking the part of a Cheyenne-like journalist or dramatist was Joseph Cotten, who is the actor, you know, from Citizen Kane and Shadow of a Doubt and other big movies of that era. And Luther Adler, brother of Stella Adler, was hired to play the Saul Alinsky-type organizer. They didn't call him Alinsky in the program. And so it was all done live in the studio and did not purport to be objective at all. It was not a piece of objective journalism. It was really to try to, it was a call to arms, to America, to recognize that this is a problem and do something about it.
All right. Well, let's play a little bit of this so people can get a feel for Eagles Brood.
I was on a train heading west. I'd been to the deep south. I lay in my berth and watched the darkness go by. I thought of Henderson on the prison farm. I thought of the teacher and the four boys, the sheriff and the judge. I thought of Mason. Mason had cared. He had yelled. He had tried to do things.
Juvenile delinquency? Brother, you've come to the right town. I know. I was born here.
Mason was young, clean-cut. He'd been in the Navy. Wore a smart gray tweed suit. He was the college instructor type. Soft-spoken, direct, honest. He was a reporter.
We're down to Shantytown. Take a look at the shacks owned by wealthy, respectable citizens. They rent them for $2-3 a week. Whole families live in them in one room with chickens and dogs and no plumbing. They're building a housing project on the edge of a garbage dump. Flies get in the milk. The smoke of the burning garbage gets into the school windows. The kids scavenge for half-open boxes of raisins. Our city offers itself to tourists. But what has it got to offer its own people? The average citizen doesn't care. He isn't interested.
What about the juvenile court?
The judge is a politician. He's running for re-election. He's got no background, no training, but he's the machine candidate, so he'll probably get in again. He's been on the bench for years. He plays God with children's lives for votes. Come election time, there are judges that send out word to the cops not to make any juvenile arrests. It's bad for the record. That's the lowdown. You can have it. I'm through with the newspaper racket. What's the good of yelling? Nobody listens. I'm getting me a job as a publicity director for a cotton firm. Fight for civic change? Don't make me laugh.
The hotel room we had talked in was on the second floor. It looked over the main street. White banners with red feathers swung in the breeze outside, lighted up by rows of electric bulbs. It was community chess campaign time. The posters in the smart shop windows showed a blonde kid in a torn sweater with an underprivileged look rising out of a big fist. The slogan read, "He's in your hand."
Subtle, isn't it?
Yeah, that just shows. And when people say, if you say radio documentary, this is not what they're going to think about. This is radio drama. That it was used actors. It was scripted. There were sound effects. There was music. It was much more like the kind of things that Joe's buddy Orson Welles and people
exactly.
like that were doing. And I suppose that's maybe natural that they took from that. Because they couldn't pick up a tape recorder and go out and record people. That's what they had done before. So it probably seemed really natural to do that again.
Yeah, actually, you mentioned Orson Welles, and of course, his most famous radio work is War of the Worlds, which used radio journalism techniques to create that sense of reality. So there's quite, again, the border separating documentary from drama was very much blurred then, and they took advantage of it. And, you know, I was poking fun a little bit at it in terms of the fact that it's not very subtle and it does have that air of melodrama to it. But you can also, hopefully, and apologies for the sound quality of these clips because obviously they're very old and taken from old recordings, but the anger behind it, and it was unfiltered anger. And you mentioned it was drama. Cheyenne, who wrote and directed this, well, I think he directed it, produced it certainly, was a dramatist. And the thing about radio drama or drama generally is it's free to take sides, whereas journalism, even in that era, it's much more constrained. Murrow aspired to objectivity, whereas the documentary unit productions did not.
Hmm. Well, I want to talk about somebody else, and this is a name that may or may not be familiar to people, but if you think about radio documentary, a name certainly that people should know is Norman Corwin.
Yeah. Who is still alive, by the way. He just celebrated his 101st birthday.
Really?
Yes.
I had no idea. Best to Norman. And here he did a show, and you can talk about it, an interesting thing called One World Flight, where unlike the kind of thing which is played, he actually took a long recorder, the kind of recorder that was available.
A wire recorder.
And actually did make field recordings.
Yeah, Norman Corwin's probably was the foremost radio dramatist of the 1930s and 1940s. Most of his works, best known works, were on CBS, and probably the best known work is something called On a Note of Triumph, which aired in May 1945 on the night the Nazis surrendered in Europe, and a very forceful call for the fight against fascism to go on. Nobody knew how much longer World War II was going to last then. Some people thought it might go on for years. And he was considered a person who was a champion of the common man. You know, the common man, capital C, capital M, was very prominent in a lot of the writing and drama of that era. And so immediately after World War II, he got the chance to go around the world to assess the prospects for post-war peace, and took along this gigantic 400-pound wire recorder, which he lugged from country to country. And think about the state of the world in 1946. He goes to Europe, to England, first of all, which has been blitzed, but certainly was triumphant in the war. Then he goes across the European continent, sees more and more destruction as he goes. He's in Warsaw a year after the Nazis have blasted that city essentially off the face of the earth. He tours the ruins of the Warsaw ghetto. He goes to the Soviet Union. He goes to China, which is in civil war, the nationalist forces versus the communist forces. He goes to India, which is in civil war. He goes to the Philippines, which was devastated in war by the Japanese. He sees widespread ignorance, poverty, and so forth, and he produces a 13-part radio series called One World Flight that airs 1947, essentially the same time as The Eagle's Brood, which we just listened to. And in spite of all that, he still comes away optimistic, which is kind of a willful act of optimism, and says, you know, we're going to go through terrible trials and agonies in this world and in this lifetime and in the lifetimes to come. But eventually, for the sake of our mutual survival, we have to come to a mutual understanding and strive for one world.
Yeah. And with this thing, that there were at least a couple of people who were ready to get in line to sponsor this, except that Norm said he didn't want any editorial interference. He said he wanted to make all calls on what was broadcast, and apparently with the sponsors, they wouldn't go for that.
Yeah, and he was wise to do that. In fact, he has always asserted that one of the smartest things he ever did was not to accept sponsorship. Henry Luce and Time Magazine was a potential sponsor, and there were others. And so he did not get the income that sponsorship would have brought him, but he did get creative freedom.
Did other sponsors, were they interested in attaching their name to these kinds of things?
Actually, the vast majority of these programs, I think pretty much everything I wrote about, were what were then called sustaining programs. Sustaining meaning non-commercially sponsored, mm-hmm. and essentially offered by the networks as public service, again, in response to regulatory pressures and just as a gesture of goodwill. As time went on, especially after about 1948 or so, that's when television really starts to come to the fore. The networks start to shift their time and resources from radio to television. And so investing all the money that went into, for example, what we just heard, again, a nationwide tour, where a top writer is essentially assigned to do nothing but that one-hour program for weeks on end for no commercial sponsorship and comparatively minuscule audiences compared mm-hmm. with the big programs of that era. The networks were just no longer willing to make that kind of commitment. They wanted commercially sponsored programming. They wanted big audiences.
Yeah. Well, that maybe gets to the question of motivation of the network brass and why it is that they did it in the first place. Bill Paley created this documentary unit, and it was really clear that he wanted CBS to be dominant. He was certainly interested in being powerful and making money, but he also, quite apart from the FCC, he seemed also to be interested in having this image that said, well, it wasn't just all about that, that he understood that there was this public service obligation, and that must have been an uneasy balance, really, between those two things.
Yeah, Paley's a really interesting figure because on the one hand, he's a mogul, and on the other hand, he does seem to have some public spiritedness about him, or at least he wants to be taken seriously in that regard. And there's also the issue that NBC was the dominant broadcast network for quite a while, really into the 1940s, into the war years. And so CBS was willing to an extent to trade audiences for prestige. By the time, again, about 1948 or so, Paley says, we're not willing to do that anymore. We want to take on NBC head on. And so they start luring some of NBC's biggest stars to CBS, like Jack Benny and others. And CBS eventually becomes the number one network. And then, of course, there's a political shift, which we haven't talked too much about yet, but there's the shift. CBS was known as a, quote, a liberal network, unquote. In fact, that seems to have persisted even to this day. And Paley was leery of that reputation, especially as the political mood became more conservative as the Cold War intensified. Yeah.
Well, that's let's go on and we can talk a little bit about that. And again, well, at some point here in the next minute or two, probably we'll play another clip. The people who were doing this work, particularly early on, clearly had this very liberal, progressive kind of orientation. Mm-hmm. But as we go through this period, this is the Cold War. There we get into the McCarthy era, a great deal of fear around communism. How did that intensification of the Cold War, how did that affect the work that these people were trying to do?
As this time period, again, we're only talking about 5 years, but you can kind of go year by year and see the mood shift. So 1945, there's residual New Deal liberalism, FDR-ism carrying over, thoughts of one world like that program we just discussed about Norman Corwin. You know, 1946, Churchill makes his Iron Curtain speech. 1947, the Truman Doctrine is issued to resist communism in Greece and Turkey, I believe. 1948, there's the Berlin crisis. There is the takeover of Czechoslovakia by a communist government. 1949, the Soviets detonate an atomic bomb, so that's a big deal. The communists take over China, and of course, by 1950, it's Korea. The war breaks out there. So with the rise in Cold War pressures and other things going on domestically, like the HUAC hearings against Hollywood in 1947, radio responds. It becomes much more difficult to put overtly liberal sentiments on the air. And even a lot of people who identify themselves as liberal are, on domestic issues at least, are still coming across very strongly anti-communist.
We'll talk some more with our guest, Matt Ehrlich, in a moment. First, though, we'll take a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, former boxing champ Sugar Ray Leonard.
There is no sweeter feeling than when you throw the perfect punch, because you get this little tingling sensation up and down your arm to let you know that you've hit the jackpot.
Leonard has a new autobiography. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. We have 10 topics for you throughout the week. Tomorrow morning in the first hour, our guest will be Rich Harwood. He's founder and president of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation, an organization that's been very influential among nonprofits trying to get engaged in the lives of their communities. He's done a lot of work taking a look at how it is that people form connections with public issues, and we'll talk some about that tomorrow. Also tomorrow, the future of the book in the electronic age. We'll talk about how e-books have changed reading and writing and publishing. Our guest will be Philip Graham, who's professor of English here at U of I, and also Martin Riker, the associate director of the Dalkey Archive Press. Then one more I'll mention, that's our monthly show on nutrition coming up on Wednesday, 10 o'clock. Susan Kundrat will be the guest. She is a licensed registered dietitian. And has a business that's called Nutrition on the Move. Celeste Quinn will host the show. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon. We have a number of topics throughout the week. You want to find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead or listen to past programs, go to our website. That is will.illinois.edu. In this hour, our guest is Matt Ehrlich. He's professor of journalism at University of Illinois. We're talking about his book, Radio Utopia, which looks at a very brief period, and that's just right from the end of World War II up until television takes off in being dominant, and looks at some of the things that people were doing with audio documentaries. And I know you like to say audio documentary because radio was not the only way that these things were. It was maybe the chief way, not the only way that they were distributed.
It's mostly what I write about. The primary non-radio example would be the I Can Hear It Now record album, which Murrow and Friendly put out in 1948 on Columbia Records. Some people out there may have heard those. It was a history, an oral history, really, of the Depression and the war years. I call it audio documentary just because this kind of work, sometimes people ask me, well, is anybody doing radio documentary anymore? And of course, if they listen to public radio, quite a bit of work is actually being done. But it's not just radio anymore. It's internet documentary and all sorts of audio media. So it's just to kind of put it in that tradition of work that's been going on for quite a while, I think longer than a lot of people realize.
Yeah. Well, I want to go and play another clip here. We were talking just before we took the short break about the Cold War and about how that intensified and what we people were thinking about and how it affected the people who were trying to do this work. It also affected the things they were doing. So I want to play a clip from something called Communism U.S. Brand.
Yes.
Set up this clip for us.
This was written by someone named Morton Wishengrad, another radio dramatist of that era. He had been a one-time socialist and actually identified himself very much as a liberal, just like Norman Corwin, just like Robert Louis Cheyon, whose Eagles Brood we were listening to earlier on juvenile delinquency. A significant difference, though, was that he was very strongly anti-communist. He had been involved with keeping communism out of the labor movement. He worked with David Dubinsky, a prominent labor leader in that. And so he was assigned by Robert Sodek, who was vice president at ABC, to produce a program on communism and the threat of communism in the United States. And we were talking about how year by year the pressures of the Cold War increased. This was 1948. Mm-hmm. And so this program aired on ABC in August of 1948 and was designed to warn about the threat of domestic communism.
All right, let's hear that.
I wonder if you realize what it is you do. You take a person who thinks of himself as a liberal and you make a sucker out of him. You take words like democracy and progressive and liberty and you twist them into meaning they're opposites. Blake, I know now why I don't like you. Some people may think you're a menace to the capitalist system. I don't think so. You're a menace to me. You're a menace to all those who call themselves liberals. You take good causes like race equality and decent housing and civil liberty, and you use them for your own ends, just as a come-on for the Soviet Union. It's too bad, Blake. I wish I could get up on a soapbox and say to the liberals, go ahead, fight your battles. Go ahead and God bless you, but fight without the help of the communists. Because the thing about a communist is that you can't trust him, no matter how noble he sounds. You can't really trust him. It's too damn bad, but that's how it is.
Yeah, just to set that up, Blake, the person who was the target of that diatribe, was a communist, an American communist, who is setting up front organizations, trying to take over labor unions and enlist well-meaning liberals like the guy we just heard, who is a doctor named Dr. Whiteside in the production. And Dr. Whiteside figures out what's going on and calls Blake on it. And eventually Blake is disappeared by his communist henchmen. So you can see similarities to what we were just playing earlier, again, docudrama, and again, live orchestra, kind of a melodramatic tone. But the political tone is different. It's instead of remaking, tackling domestic problems and remaking America for the better, it's resisting a Soviet-directed threat from abroad.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure that people will know about, or at least a little bit about, during this time, there was the investigation of the film industry.
Right.
And allegations about people being in the business and being in, affiliated with the Communist Party or being on the left politically. Well, there also was a, I think, less well-known but similar kind of thing went on with radio as well. And how were some of the people that were involved in producing the work that you write about caught up in that?
The investigation of the broadcast industry really took hold a couple of years after the program we just heard, 2 or 3 years after the HUAC investigation of the Hollywood industry, and most prominently in a publication called Red Channels, which was put together by a small group of former FBI agents. And they listed, I think it was 250, or don't remember the exact number, but quite a few people in the broadcast industry, especially radio, television writers and performers, who were thought to have left-leaning sympathies. And, you know, the book did not circulate that much outside of New York City. It's very, very difficult to find a copy of it today. I had to go to the Library of Congress to actually find an actual copy of the book. But the broadcasters took that essentially, by the broadcasters, I mean the networks, the William Paley's of the world, to essentially say, you're not going to be on our networks anymore. So that led to blacklisting. We mentioned Norman Corwin. Norman Corwin was listed in Red Channels. Robert Louis Cheyenne, who did the juvenile delinquency documentary, was listed in Red Channels. Robert Heller, another person in the CBS documentary unit, was listed in Red Channels. Luther Adler, who performed in The Eagle's Brood, was, and quite a few others. And the result was essentially they could not find work in radio or television for quite a while.
Yeah. Well, the two clips that we've heard were representative of the kind of work that was done, at least early on, and that was much like the kind of radio drama work that had come before. Things did change, although one thing that really caught my eye, I thought that was pretty interesting. I think actually at one point, and I don't know if it was Corwin that they were talking about, but there was somebody had done a documentary where they actually used what we call actualities. That is, they interviewed people and they had people talking, and that it was the critic didn't like it because it wasn't dramatic enough.
Yeah, that struck me too. The program you're talking about was something called We Went Back. And it aired on the anniversary of the end of the war, and they went to former war zones like Corregidor and Berlin and elsewhere and actually did recordings. And the Variety critic, Variety regularly reviewed these documentaries when they aired, said exactly what you just said. They said a good actor and director is usually much more effective in driving home the truth than recorded actuality is. So again, it points up the fact that as of 1947, 1948, the definition of documentary was extremely fluid, as in fact it is today. You think of a lot of dramatized documentary, and is it in fact documentary? Is it in fact drama? I think a lot of times those discussions aren't terribly productive, but certainly they were having those discussions back in the 40s as well.
Well, at some point, and in part it may have been because of the change in technology, when it became easier to have a portable recorder that you could actually take out with you to talk to people, that it did change, and the documentary work started to look more like to sound more like what it is we would think of when we say radio documentary.
Yeah, Hear It Now, the Murrow Friendly radio series of 1950-1951, you're actually hearing recorded reports from the Korea War front, sounds of shelling, an on-scene report from a MASH unit, an actual surgical hospital from Korea. There was the change in technology. Also, CBS and NBC had for many years a recording ban, and they dropped that ban in part because the big stars of that era didn't want to go live anymore. It was too much of a hassle for them. They would have to do the programs twice, once for the east half of the country and then again for the west half of the country. So all those kinds of factors contributed to that. In terms of a shift in philosophy, I guess, of documentary, what you hear is a shift from this kind of angry idealism of the early docudramas to much more hard-nosed realism, as opposed to let's imagine the world as it could be. Let's instead hear the world as it really is. And the world as it really is as of 1950 is a dangerous, scary place. Mm-hmm. And so the spirit also changes.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with Matt Ehrlich. He's professor of journalism at University of Illinois. We're talking about some of what you'll find in his book, Radio Utopia, a post-war audio documentary in the public interest. And it is published by the University of Illinois Press. And there is a website for the book, and there are a number of clips on there, the ones that we've played, but there's some others. So if people at least want to get a flavor of some of the things that we're talking about, and I think, for example, there's you have some of One World Flight on there, that thing we mentioned by Norm Corman and some others. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, the telephone numbers. We also have the possibility of an email. If you'd like to send in your comment that way, it is will-talk at illinois.edu. And we have a couple of callers here, and let's talk with them. First, in Effingham, line number four. Hello.
Yes, thank you again. I think from what you say, David, that keep it on subject, and that's what I hope I'm doing. The subject is always the same, but the time periods are different, in my opinion. We have moved forward with the very things you've been talking about, and on into TV and now into cyberism. And the effects of world events now are reflected off of that. Well, in the 1980s, I think it was, or maybe there just before the Soviet Union fell, that an old fellow asked a reporter, who is going to be your enemy now? When the USSR goes away, he's saying this to a reporter from the U.S., who will be your enemy now? Well, that updated things into the 90s there, and 2000 comes along George Bush, who was asked by a reporter, what about the Twin Towers coming down, and why? And his answer was, they hate us. That's the only thing I ever heard come from him about the extension. He right away then went off onto the axis of evil and all those crazy things that evolved, you know, over the 20th century. And are my comments pertinent? Why don't we know more about world history and the effects of the colonial periods and all those that have reflect off of the very things that are happening today, just like they did when in 1917, when the Russian Revolution was accomplished, which was attacked by 16 different countries to put that down, and it failed. But I guess my basic question is, nothing changes. Why didn't we understand more? Why do they hate us?
Well, it's interesting that yesterday I was up in Chicago at the Printers Row Lit Fest. I was actually on a panel with two other authors. One was writing about the Vietnam era, and one was writing about the era right now, specifically about the whole Scooter Libby thing and the use of unnamed sources and targeting Valerie Plame and so forth. And we kind of came to that conclusion that a lot of these issues do reoccur. The political pressures on radio specifically and on media generally, questions about the role that journalism should play in times of war. Should you be a booster for whatever war effort is going on, regardless of who the enemy is perceived to be? And so the issues of the late 1940s, in fact, are still relevant today in that sense.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned that also at this point, the FCC was trying to put some pressure on broadcasters to remind them that they had a public service obligation.
Yeah.
And they mostly seemed interested in making money, but they made what concessions they had to. And it seems that that's never really been something that I think the FCC has pushed very hard.
Well, they pushed it harder back then than I think they typically do now. Of course, the media marketplace is considerably different now than it was in the 1940s. But questions of media policy are still very much at the forefront. And if nothing else, this little heyday of audio documentary does provide some evidence that government regulatory pressure can have some impact on programming. I would argue a salutary impact on programming.
All right. I think, Koala, let's go to Champaign County here, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, when you mentioned red channels, how directly was CBS and particularly Murrow's outfit affected by, or did he throw people under the bus? And it's widely said that Murrow was the guy that challenged McCarthy when the Army hearings came up. And I'm wondering if he was really early on that, or whether, whether he watched some of his confreres get axed well in advance of that happening. And
yes.
I was also interested to note that Harvest of Shame was his last documentary for, and there's another way, I guess, of getting people out of that business, and he was hired by Kennedy to be the head of the USIA in the last 5 years of his life or something.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to see what he did in that capacity, too. Thanks. I'll listen.
All right. Yeah, Murrow is a very interesting figure, a very complicated figure, and yes, he is venerated by a lot of people today and in movies like Good Night and Good Luck, which came out a few years ago, as being a great opponent against McCarthyism. At the same time, when Red Channels came out in 1950 and when folks like Robert Louis Cheyenne, who had been a colleague of Murrow, were listed in Red Channels, Murrow did nothing whatsoever to try to rescue Cheyenne or to boost his career. He did help one or two others who were listed in Red Channels, but he's always trying to negotiate kind of a middle path between the pressures on broadcasters to resist communism and at the same time remain an objective voice. Just really briefly, there is a Hear It Now program, actually the last one that ever aired from 1951, where Murrow takes on McCarthy. It was when McCarthy delivered his speech attacking George Marshall, and the little speech that is remembered for the conspiracy so immense line, the worst conspiracy in the history of the American Republic. And Murrow attacks McCarthy at that time, but does it in a very circumspect sort of way. So what I do try to do in this book is kind of give a flavor of the difficult path that Murrow was trying to lead and the fact that he was very complicated on questions of anti-communism and as well as other issues.
Yeah. We're just about the point. We have a couple of minutes left. I do want to play one more thing just because I think there is again, audio on your website for the book so people can listen. And what we did is we picked some of the pieces that were shorter that it would be easier for us to play.
The musical documentary.
This is 1960 Jiminy Cricket that I wanted to play just because it seems so sort of strange.
Yeah, this an ABC documentary from 1947, an 800-page think tank report that they turn into a Walt Disney musical with the Seven Dwarves and Donald Duck and Jiminy Cricket, who I think we're going to hear. Again, apologies for the sound quality.
Yeah.
I'm full of fun and fancy free. That's the way I want to be. Well, there are a few things we haven't even mentioned. From where we sit, 19 City looks like the promised land. But there are still some big ifs. If there's no war, and if nobody gets trigger-happy with atomic bombs, if our statesmen practice statesmanship and use their mandate with wisdom, and, of course, if a major depression doesn't paralyze the world, and there's another footnote, we haven't mentioned any other country because this has been the story of America in 1960. But the welfare of the other countries it's our welfare, too. If our land is to be filled with plenty and peace and happiness 12 years from now, it'll be because we have reached out a helping hand across the seas where words like needs and resources have a very different meaning. It's worth working for, don't you think? It may not be perfect, but by Jiminy, it's worth working for. So climb right on my song and come with me. 1960 is full of fun and fancy free.
I hope, I hope, and I hope, for if you're feeling low, you positively can't go wrong with a high, high hope.
Yeah, it's good that war and depression are not issues anymore. Again, history has lessons to teach us, so.
It's just that's just remarkable. Just as a way of finishing up, I guess I'd like to acknowledge one more time that people still do radio documentary. It's pretty amazing to me that it actually still survives. And pretty much, though, I think it's now the province, exclusively the province of the non-commercial broadcasters.
Yeah, and again, pretty much all the work I write about was non-commercial, which itself is provocative, I guess.
Our guest in this hour is Matt Ehrlich. He's professor of journalism at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His book is Radio Utopia, Postwar Audio Documentary in the Public Interest, and it's published by the University of Illinois Press. And as I mentioned, there's a website,
which you can link to from, if you go to the University of Illinois Press website and look up Radio Utopia, you can link to the website from there.
That's right. And so you can hear, if you'd like to hear those clips again, or there are a number of others there, you can look at the book and listen to some examples. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, David.